This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll revisit our show on what could be next for local news. Newspapers in particular have been on the decline for years in communities across the country. We'll talk to guests today about why it's happening and whether anything seems to be replacing the local coverage that's being lost. We're joined now by Bob Zaltzberg, special projects editor at WFIU-WTIU News and former editor at the Herald Times newspaper in Bloomington. Welcome, Bob. I want to start with asking a little bit about your time at the Herald Times. How long were you there?
So I was the editor of the paper for 33 years. In full, I was there for 42 years, but I was the person running the news department for 33.
So you've seen a lot of changes then. You've seen, I guess, the way things were and the way things are now.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've seen a lot of change. You know, we could see that change was on the horizon a long time ago, even with, you know, with the advent of cable news networks and USA Today and a lot of things like that. But then the acceleration of that change with the digital transformation has been just astounding to watch. And it definitely put newspapers, print on paper, ink on paper, at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And then I don't think the industry really handled it all that well by really holding to the ink on paper model and the advertising driven model for as long as it did. And I'm not saying that I had any better idea, but I think that we held on a little too long.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, what should have happened and when. But I'm curious about, you know, there's a lot of corporate buyouts happening right now. When you were at the paper, who was the owner at the time?
So I worked for the Schurz family. It was Schurz Communications Incorporated, and I worked for them until the day I retired, which was January 31st, 2019. But on February 1st, 2019, the day after I retired, the Gatehouse Company took over the paper, and then Gatehouse and Gannett merged. Actually, one thing that a lot of people probably don't realize is that the Gatehouse Company and its hedge fund owners were kind of the company that took over Gannett, and Gannett is now a part of that company, and they took on the Gannett name. So Gannett now owns the Herald Times as well as the Indianapolis Star and numerous other papers in Indiana and across the country.
Mm-hmm. Does that change the way news is covered if one company is owning all of these newspapers? Does it take away sort of the local flavor?
Well, it changed it dramatically in Bloomington. And, you know, things would not be any different if I was editor of the paper today under this ownership. Mm-hmm. But the ownership has changed things dramatically. It's reduced the number of journalists covering the community by a huge number. I think the day I left, I think there were still 29 local journalists working in reporting and layout and design, photography, those kinds of things. And I think I don't have the exact number, but it's 10 or 11 that they have in that newsroom now. So that's a huge reduction. And that 29 was down from close to 50 at one point during my career. So that's been a huge change. The idea of printing the newspaper off site has been a huge change. It's changed the deadlines considerably. And then, you know, the point that you made about having a lot of the same ownership for a lot of newspapers, it just makes all the websites look the same. It makes all the newspapers look the same. But there are still local journalists in those communities. The few that are there are still trying to cover their local communities and I would say doing a good job under some really difficult circumstances.
Right, right. It just seems like these newsrooms keep shrinking. I'm curious about, you know, working for a paper that is a family-owned newspaper versus being owned by a big corporation. Is there any difference or would readers not even notice?
No, I think readers would notice a great deal. I mean, we were a family-owned newspaper and a member of the family lived in Bloomington. It was a small family-owned group, but there were a dozen or so newspapers, and you could get a hold of somebody with the last name of Schurz if you had a major issue. And the people who had the last name of Schurz knew the journalist who worked for them, and the journalist could always get to the ownership of the newspaper. Now there's so many different levels between the people who actually work in the newsroom and the people that are setting policy and running the news organization. I think it's a huge difference for how a local community gets covered.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it has anything to do with transparency. Does that affect it at all?
I don't know about the transparency issue. I don't think that the Gannett people, I'm not anti-Gannett. I'm not evil. I don't think Gannett is evil or anything. I don't think that they're dictating that the local newspapers need to cover things in a particular way or they need to take a particular editorial stance. I think the issue is more that they've just reduced the number of journalists. They've reduced the amount of things that people can cover. They've reduced budgets all around. And we used to be able to cover Indiana University athletics in Bloomington, had a budget to do it, could go on the road with them, could do a lot of things and present news to our readers that was unique and unusual. That's not happening anymore. Since we were printed in the local community, we could get things into the newspaper on a timely basis. You know, the next day, that isn't happening anymore. There's not really much of a local editorial page anymore. You know, when I was there, and again, it's not about me, but when I was there, I was writing local editorials, doing commentary on local issues and running tons and tons of letters to the editor. There's an editorial page now that still has letters to the editor, but there's rarely a locally written position by the newspaper. So, you know, it just makes a big difference when there is a corporation that purchases it just because of the amount of resources that the local newspaper has offered to them. Because, of course, there has to be a certain level of profit made. And when you have a family-owned newspaper, of course they want to make a profit, but they're willing to take a lower level of profit. Mm-hmm. And it's not about serving their stockholders as much as it is, you know, serving family members and serving their communities and serving the people who work for them and mm-hmm. Working as a team and a partnership.
Well, when you look back at profit for the paper when you were working there, I mean, what was it like turning a profit then versus now? Was it easier or was it harder?
Well, I think there was a time when it was much easier, much, much easier. And, you know, I'm certainly shouldn't talk about profit margins and things of that nature, but profit margins were going down, you know, as I was there. So the amount of money that was being made, the percentage of money that was being made was certainly on was trending downward. But we had a lot of very strong local advertisers. I think with newspapers, and Jonas can probably talk about this, the second half of the program, newspapers used to own the real estate market. They used to own the automotive market. They used to have, you know, a lot of the big department stores in town. Well, you look around the community today, and there aren't big department stores. And the realtors do their own thing online, and the auto dealers are doing their own thing online. So mm-hmm. those are huge segments of the revenue that just isn't going to newspapers anymore. So that made it really difficult to turn that profit, because of course profit is, you know, how much revenue you can bring in minus the expense that you put out. So if you're not bringing that much revenue in, you have to cut the expense to maintain the same level of profit. So the profits were definitely on the downswing when I was still there. But now I think the profits have probably gone back up, but at the detriment of the expenses that the newspapers were willing to put out.
Right. And I mean, you were there probably watching this transition from traditional to digital and all of that. I mean, what was that like? Was it fear of the unknown? Were people excited?
Well, I look back on it and I think we were really proud at how aggressive we thought we were in going into the digital market. And we were one of the first newspapers in the country that actually charged for digital content. I look back on it now and I think, yeah, we did a pretty good job relative to other newspapers. But relative to other newspapers was still not a very good job of making this transition. So, you know, we were making a little bit of money on the digital side, but not nearly enough to, we were still betting on the fact that print was going to still be there and all that revenue that was coming into print was still going to stay strong. And I don't think we really anticipated well enough anyway, just the total transition to a more digital style of presenting news and information.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder how tough it is, you know, in general for newspapers with so many outlets popping up left and right. It's like anybody can just start something up.
That's absolutely true. And I think that, I think that what I would call news literacy is such an important thing these days, because mm-hmm. I do think that the local journalists in the newspapers around the state of Indiana and around the nation, they're still doing their best to present fair and honest coverage of their communities, but there just aren't enough of them. And so these other news outlets that are popping up, some of them are doing a great job. You know, I think about Chalkbeat as a nonprofit news organization. It's doing a great job on education. But, you know, in a local community, we've got three or four different sort of one-man bands out there doing their thing. And they're doing it reasonably well, but in a very narrow niche. You know, one guy's covering a lot of local government, doing a pretty good job. One person's covering a lot of cops and nighttime news and trauma, and he's doing a good job. But nobody's covering, you know, that entire range of the community the way the local newspaper used to.
Right. And so probably for audiences, if you're just focusing one thing, you're not getting a broader picture if you open up a paper.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I do have to mention the fact that I think that public radio is filling some of this niche by increasing the staff and local communities to try to fill some of that void that is being left behind by local newspapers. And I think that's a positive. I think nonprofit news is going to be something we're going to have to look at, you know, in the future.
Well, we have about 30 seconds here. How has the paper changed since you retired? Have you seen anything else change?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of things have changed. I mean, the entire design of the paper is different. It looks exactly like the Indianapolis Star and other Gannett papers now. The deadlines have changed, so nothing gets in the next day. A lot of features have disappeared from the paper. The editor, news director is what she's called, wrote a column the other day saying they were not going to be accepting nearly as much submitted news, which is a lot of that chicken dinner refrigerator. You know, it's not the biggest news in town, but it's stuff that gets people reading the paper and people want to look at. They're not going to be taking much of that anymore. And so there are just numerous ways that it's changed.
All right. Well, we'll touch more on that after a quick break. We're talking about the current state of local news in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're reflecting on the last 2 years of the pandemic in Indiana with two health experts who've been talking us through it since it began. We're joined by Shandy Dirth and Tom Dzinski, both from the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. Shandy, before the break, we were talking a little bit about how Indiana has been communicating with the general public since the pandemic started. What about how all the different levels of government have communicated and worked together? Has there been a clear process for that, or maybe a process that's solidified over time?
Yes and no. I would say if you ask local health departments, if communication has always been clear, you're going to hear some no's in that. I think it's definitely improved over time. And I know the state agencies are always working on improving that. And I would say that's true not just for Indiana, but for all states. I think there's constantly a need for improvement between communication between people on the ground doing the work at the local level and people at the state and federal level with the supplies, with the funding, that sort of thing. I do think that's improving. I know with the health departments and the state health department, they've had regular calls each week since the beginning, which has been, they've been really, really helpful. And then they have Q&A sessions on there. They've set up, you know, email inboxes specifically for certain parts of the COVID response, whether it be vaccine, testing, that sort of thing. So all of that's been really helpful. And at the same time, I just want to point out that the Indiana Department of Health has been just as understaffed as the local health departments in the state. So when I say we need to build up public health, we need to build up all aspects of public health. And so if we could keep the staffing levels strong, I think that communication would just naturally improve the next time around.
You know, we've talked a lot about staffing levels for nurses, for example, and other folks in healthcare. Would you say that public health is facing a similar situation where people are retiring and leaving the field and not enough are coming back in?
It's a definite crisis. So not only are they retiring, some people retired because they were going to retire before COVID. They stuck it out to get everyone through COVID, and they're just done. Or honestly, COVID burned them out to the point where they're taking early retirements. Or I'm seeing a lot of mass exodus right now in local health departments because staff have been burned out. They've been attacked. I mean, we've had really good public health leaders in the state just leave their positions because they've just been abused by the public too often, unfortunately. And I would have never expected to see that during all of this. And so we've got a definite staffing crisis in the state, but also, again, across the U.S. Indiana is not unique in this. Epidemiologists, you know, the field that Tom and I, you know, live in every day, there's a huge need for epidemiology right now. So in addition to staffing, we need to train those people. We need more programs in schools of public health to train more people, more faculty to train those people, because we have seen that mass exodus and we need to fill that gap quickly. Because otherwise, as we've seen, we pay the price when we're too understaffed in those areas.
Right. I wonder, I mean, I was thinking with the spotlight sort of lit up on public health and people understanding more about this field and as a career path. Tom, do you think there's been more interest in public health careers? Have you seen folks express that they want to get involved, or are they scared because of the burnout?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, we have seen an increase in our School of Public Health, right? The enrollment actually went up in our School of Public Health. People seeking more education around public health and epidemiology and social behavioral sciences. We see that increase because other schools on our campus, their enrollment actually went down during the pandemic. You know, and some of this has to do with the fear of being out in public and in large classrooms with a lot of people and stuff. But there's been a spotlight on public health, good or bad, however you want to look at it, and interest in the sciences itself. You know, Shandy brought up this point about epidemiologists. The Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists, which is across the country, they do a survey of need about every 5 years. And prior to the pandemic, we needed a 36% increase in the number of epidemiologists in this country just to get to where we should be. So we were already in a deficit to begin with. And the pandemic, as Shandy indicated, has made it a little bit worse. So I'm hoping, given the education we've been putting out, working with you on this radio program, for example, telling people what epidemiology is and what public health is and what we do, will actually bring more people to the science and hopefully get us back up to capacity.
Well, educating the public about this field is one thing. There's also the idea that there's been some misinformation as an issue during this pandemic, whether it's misinformation about the work that you do or just misinformation around the pandemic. Do any specific things stick out to you as particularly harmful, Tom, that you've seen in the last 2 years?
I think the biggest thing that concerned me was not doing the basic protective measures, right? Vaccines are wonderful. You know, I've been saying the mRNA, the M stands for a miracle because it's really has been tremendous. But prior to vaccines and treatments, those basic public health messages about, you know, keeping a mask on, physical distancing, good hand hygiene, were just simply being ignored by so many people. They were very cavalier and like the virus isn't going to hurt me and things like that. And unfortunately, the numbers tell a different story, whether it's cases, hospitalizations, or deaths. And we've seen a lot of people, unfortunately, in Indiana and across the U.S., maybe at a higher rate than some other countries, die unnecessarily from this disease.
Shandy, are there any things you think that have caused the most information to spread?
So there's actually been a lot of research in that area, and you can pinpoint some specific lies, basically pointing to like internet sources. And so we've all been battling the issue of whether or not the vaccine can affect fertility. And basically it was a guy in Australia made that go viral. And so the internet can be great for sharing, you know, up-to-date information and truth. But unfortunately, we've seen it go the other way during COVID. And there are researchers out there right now trying to pinpoint exactly how those spiraled out of control. And as you've probably seen, the Surgeon General is really attacking misinformation. And he's going at the corporate offices at this point, too, to say, you need to share some information with us because we have to figure out how to fix this for next time. And as we talk about vaccines, it's horrendous that we don't have higher vaccination rates. the deaths we're seeing right now, you know, most of them really could have been prevented with vaccines, but then some of that is going to spill over to our other vaccines that we've had available and in use for decades. And my fear is that, you know, the next outbreak is going to be measles or mumps or polio. That's not been eradicated yet. We still have that in other countries. And so we really need to get ahead of this misinformation cycle that we somehow hopped on in the last few years and get control of that again.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I don't mind interject here, Shandy, you're right, this misinformation. So I'm glad to see some of these social media platforms actually taking a proactive stance against misinformation, and people posting misinformation actually gets checked and removed in some instances. So to me, that's a really good thing. Others see it as an infringement on their freedom of speech. But we remember these are private companies and they can kind of control the narrative if they want.
Well, and I like to point out, too, I can't walk into a crowded theater and yell fire if it's not true.
Correct.
So at this point, COVID is, you know, a raging forest fire taking out millions of people across the globe. And so at this point, I think it should be illegal to knowingly spread misinformation at this point.
Yeah, it's definitely unfortunate just how rapidly misinformation spreads. And I think we've done shows on this in the past where for some reason, negative information spreads quicker. And people are more likely to engage with that stuff. Tom, what are some of the primary ways you think health officials and governments have tried to combat misinformation aside from maybe trying to go after these companies?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's been putting consistent faces around some of this information. So as Shandy mentioned, the Surgeon General, right? You want somebody kind of be the face of the pandemic here in the U.S., whether that's Dr. Fauci or the Surgeon General or whomever, right? We want people of reputation and science and can speak to people and kind of where what Shandy indicated, meet them where they're at with good, solid information, right? And be consistent around that. I think those are important strategies that we've seen the government start doing, right? That we have these sort of consistent partners that we look to. And that's what I would encourage a lot of your listeners to do as well, is find that consistent, reputable source of information, like your primary care provider, your state or local health department, all wonderful people working really hard, understanding the science and trying to communicate to individuals to improve or, you know, improve their health or even prevent disease.
Shandy, there's the misinformation, there's conspiracy theories that have had an impact on vaccine rates and social behavior, I think. Have you seen that here in Indiana, that these things have convinced folks, for example, to not get vaccinated?
Oh, definitely. We've seen that. I would say probably every bit of misinformation that's anywhere in the world has at some point entered into Indiana. So we've had to battle that here. And it's evident, obviously, with some of our lower vaccination rates, especially in some of the rural areas. And so that's unfortunate. I'm really discouraged by, again, the fertility issue, the fact that people don't understand that the vaccines are safe, that we're not just putting them out there for profit or something like that. I mean, it's a lot of work to get the vaccines out. No one's going to spend that amount of time or effort. That's not a good vaccine. It's not something we need to do. So again, we need to, you know, gain the trust of the public and get them to understand who we are and what we do. And, you know, public health before COVID, we all talked about how no one knew what public health was. And now that people know us because of COVID, so many people are mad at us because of what we tell you can't do. I think we need to go back to the basics and teach people again, you know, public health is what helps keep your water safe to drink. It's what keeps, you know, the streams clean so you can go fishing on the weekends with your kids. You know, we do all of those little steps along the way that you don't think about and that you take for granted. And you can't take for granted because you don't have, you know, if you're not in the field, you're not doing the work. And so I think we need to build that trust with the community past COVID. Otherwise, I think this misinformation will just keep spreading.
I think we might need to have some kind of a reality show where we follow you and Tom around and see what you do.
That could be good and bad, but yes, I'm sure we've talked about that. Actually, to do a communication campaign around Indiana, we're working on that actually with IU right now and some of the local health officers around the state, and we are really going to start doing some of that work in the coming months so people understand what public health is and so there's a greater appreciation. Unfortunately, what we've seen in the Indiana legislation in the last year is a lot of public health authority has been removed, and that's really detrimental to the health and financial safety, honestly, of the state. Things like the septic bill that was going through, you know, last week, that can have some pretty grave consequences for homeowners. And so we definitely need to get the word out there to the general public.
When you look back, Tom, at the last 2 years, did you ever envision that working in public health would be considered almost a dangerous job?
No, to be honest. And, you know, since being interviewed so many times, not only with your program, but with other media outlets and such. I mean, I know Shandy and I both received, you know, some odd phone calls and just, you know, things that didn't seem quite right that we've obviously reported. But I never really thought that we would be the source of an attack, basically, against public health. I mean, Shani brought up, you know, these ideas behind septic systems and clean water, but even the clean food that we take for granted every day, right? These are all public health things. And we don't necessarily do these jobs for credit and say, oh, look what we did for everybody, right? We're really invested in the public's health. And we recognize the healthy community is a happy community. It's a prosperous community, right? And we're not going to advance as a society until we improve our health across the board. So that's what I get great pleasure out of working in public health in, and I'm sure others have as well. But yeah, it's been a real eye-opener for us to see some of these public health people that, you know, both Shandy and I look up to just walk away from the position because of the threats and stuff.
Shandy, what are your feelings about this in the last 2 years, just seeing sort of the discussion and commentary around this field?
So I agree with Tom. I would have never expected the attacks. I mean, I understand sometimes we aren't the welcomed people. You know, I used to be a restaurant inspector eons ago when I was first out of college, so I wasn't always the person restaurant owner might want to see. But, you know, a good restaurant owner also understood that we would help protect them from causing an outbreak that would kill their business. And I think that respect has been lost out there in the community, unfortunately. I have been saddened to see the attacks on the leaders in public health. As Tom mentioned, he and I have had weird phone calls, some, you know, sometimes hateful emails, that sort of thing. But I've never felt, you know, where I was unsafe. It was never that bad where I was worried about myself or my family. I can say I've had several conversations with public health people around the state and here in Indiana who received death threats. I had a health officer tell me not that long ago that he still does not stand in his living room in the middle of the night with his curtains open. Wow. I had another health officer say that he kept track of all of the threats against him, and he showed his wife where it was locked up, and she was to give that to the police if something should happen to him. So these threats have been severe. It's caused a lot of people to leave, and we really need, you know, we need to get people to back off of that. We need these public health officials. As Tom said, people don't enter public health for like the glamour. I think my first day on the job in public health, I was pouring dye down a toilet to do a dye test at a house. And also, I mean, a lot of people go into this field. They've got a lot of school loans. They're not making a lot of money, but they're really dedicated to improving their community. So they're not out there to take anyone's rights away or to tell someone not to do something. They really are trying to make a better community for their family members and for their friends.
Yeah, it's a shame that there's a misunderstanding and misinformation around a field that you think it has nothing to do with politics. It's just a general field trying to make us safer and healthier.
Right. We tried to just follow the science, honestly, and ignore the politics. But unfortunately, sometimes the politics really, you know, affect what we can and cannot do.
Before we head to break, Tom, are there any things that you learned about the virus that we didn't understand at the beginning that you know now? And we can pick up on this when we get back from break as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've learned so much about this virus and the people it affects and how it affects them. And honestly, we're going to keep learning more about this particular virus probably for the next decade.
Is there anything specific that you saw that changed your mind about the virus from when you first learned about it?
I think the biggest thing is, you know, especially when we looked at things like Delta and Omicron, is how it transitioned to be more infectious, right? So it took less viral particles to actually infect people. And this is a piece of evolution that we see with viruses and pandemics, essentially, that in order to kind of survive, they have to adapt to their environment, just like we do, right? But they're very efficient at it. And it's been kind of surprising to me just how fast and efficient this virus became.
And that was Tom Dzinski and Shandy Dearth, both from the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. Just ahead, we'll learn about significant figures in Indiana women's history. Stay with us. We'll be back in 90 seconds. I'm Miriam Sobe, and this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we look back at a few of our favorite segments from this past week on All In. A reminder, this show is not live. We're now going to listen to a discussion about the women's suffrage movement, and we are joined by two guests, Michelle Marino, Deputy Director for the Indiana Historical Bureau, and Jill Wee Simmons, Staff Historian for the Indiana Historical Bureau. Michelle, a big part of women's history in the U.S. was the suffrage movement. Were there any Hoosier women who played a large role in the movement overall?
Yeah, there's actually a lot that are pretty recognizable, and not only here throughout the state of Indiana, but then also played prominent roles in the national movement as well, and sort of buddy-buddy with some of the famous names you hear, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and others. But just, you know, a few, if we're going to name drop women here for a second, but Mary Garrett Hay is a famous suffragist from Indiana who's a longtime partner of Carrie Chapman Catt. We have a historical marker to her down in Charleston, Indiana. May Wright Sewell was a very prominent Hoosier suffragist. It was involved in education and women's clubs and in other things here throughout the state, but then involved on the national suffrage level, but then also promoting peace and other organizations to Ida Husted Harper, who writes sort of the biography, I'm not sure that's the right word, but writes the story,
overview,
something like that, of the national women's suffrage movement. So yeah, there's really prominent Hoosiers that sort of got their start here and then again sort of spread out, you know, to go on speaking tours in New York and to be a part of the national organizations as well.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, I don't know that we necessarily think of Indiana when we think of the suffrage movement, because I think a lot of the historical references are to the national movement. Do you think there's more that can be done, you know, on the local levels of different states to bring prominence to some of these women?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that Dr. Anita Morgan points out in her influential book on the Indiana women's suffrage movement called We Must Be Fearless is one of the interesting things about the Indiana suffrage movement is its diversity. We see working class women and upper class women uniting. We see African-American women involved in the fight from the very beginning through the very end. Jewish women, German immigrants, and women across the political spectrum. So one of the things that we're trying to do at the Historical Bureau is place state historical markers for as many of these diverse group of women as we can. So we're starting to see a little bit of that come to fruition.
And can you tell us about this? Oh, sorry, just real quick. I'm just curious what the historical markers are. Are these like placards or something somewhere when you're going throughout the state that you'll see some commemoration?
Yeah, so the Historical Bureau is in charge of the State Historical Marker Program, and we actually have over 700 markers across the state. So these are like big metal signs that are in the ground. There's several here on the State House lawn and on the state government complex and all over downtown Indianapolis that just tell Hoosier stories, essentially sort of a starting point of returning the stories to the landscape. And, you know, representing diverse Hoosiers and all the things they're involved in. And the program's been going on since the 1940s. So we're just really with the centennial of women's suffrage in 2020 really hitting home that there's a lot more stories out there that we need to tell.
And it's a publicly driven program. So Hoosiers around the state can come to us and say, you know, I know about this very important woman in my community and would love to get a marker. Or even we've worked with leaders in the Indiana General Assembly and the Lieutenant Governor. And in this case, you know, they had to kind of fight to get that story of the Indiana woman suffrage movement returned to the landscape at the State House by actually passing a resolution to place it there.
Who are the women that were leading the suffrage movement for minority communities here in Indiana? Do we know who any of them were?
Yes. So as early as 1869, at the first meeting of the Indiana Women's Rights Association that was held after the Civil War, that association was established in the 1850s, is the first time that historians have been able to document African-American women's participation. We assume that they were involved from the beginning. But at this meeting, one African-American woman stood in front of this group and demanded that they assure her that Black voices would be included. The association agreed, and they remained an essential part of the fight. We know more about Black groups in Indianapolis. This really is an area where historians are doing the work right now. Our colleague Kisha Tandy at the Indiana State Museum has been leading some of this work, gathering the names of influential suffragists. But one that stands out to us is Carrie Barnes. And she was a public school teacher who helped to organize the Equal Suffrage Association, which was, I'm sure we'll get to this later, but one of two prominent suffrage associations. And in 1912, she helped organize an all African-American branch. And the first meeting was held at the house of famous Black entrepreneur, Madam C.J. Walker. I know, I think you recently had a segment on Madam Walker. But Carrie Barnes was elected president. And there's this great quote that Dr. Morgan pulls out in her book. And she says, Carrie Barnes said, "We all feel that colored women have need for the ballot that white women have, and many, and a great many needs that they have not." And they, Black suffragists, including this branch number 7, went on to host debates at the Senate Avenue YMCA, which was really an important center for Black culture at the time, at local churches. And they worked with other suffrage groups and trade unions to forward women's rights to vote. So we're still doing the work here, but she's one that stands out to us.
If you're listening live and have any questions or comments for the program, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. Leave us a message there, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. We're talking today about significant figures in Indiana women's history in light of Women's History Month, and we're joined by Michelle Marino, Deputy Director for the Indiana Historical Bureau, and Jill Wee Simmons, Staff Historian for the Indiana Historical Bureau. Michelle, how did women of different backgrounds work together in Indiana to strengthen the suffrage movement? I guess what I'm wondering is, were they the ideal model to show us that, you know, when we all work together, we have a great accomplishment that we can do?
Yeah, so there's a lot of points to draw out on what you just said there. You know, when we think of suffragists, unfortunately, you sort of have this image of white middle-class suffragists. And there certainly were a lot of them and had been really working early on since the mid-19th century. And then again, after the Civil War, you know, pushing for women's suffrage and women's rights. But they also realized that they couldn't do it alone. And they needed women from the working class, from the labor unions, of different backgrounds and ethnicities. And so you saw that on the national level, but you also saw that here within Indiana as well.
These women are savvy political actors with a whole range of opinions on strategy about how to achieve the vote. So some women felt like they should be working just for partial suffrage to be able to vote in local elections, for instance, and that would wedge the door open and then they could work for further rights. Other women passionately believed that they were due their full rights as citizens and wanted to work for nothing less than full suffrage. So as you can imagine, these different groups clashed, and you know, they clashed over other issues like prohibition. And so, you know, they had some knockdown, drag down fights over this, just like male politicians were doing all the time. Sometimes when the women did it, newspapers would be critical of them, treat them as if they were being petty. But of course, they were working out strategies and working through their differences. But we do have some interesting examples of when they unite to really just push for the vote, especially once we get to like 1911, 1912.
Yeah, because they really realized in the 20th century that they needed to put pressure on all fronts. They couldn't strategically afford to put all their eggs in sort of one basket, if you will, that they had to push for a constitutional amendment, that they had to push for state amendments. You know, they're coming at it from all angles. And that really is when they realize, like, all hands on deck, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like there's just a lot going on. Would you say that they were successful by having protests here in Indiana? And if so, what kind of protests did the suffragists organize?
They came together several times. There were two main suffrage groups, the Women's Franchise League and the Equal Suffrage Association, as we mentioned, differing over strategy, but they would come together to show their force, to show the suffrage movement was not a fringe movement. It's not just a few extremists calling for the vote, that Hoosier women were demanding the vote. And one of my favorite examples is in 1913, when those two suffrage groups came together. There were several votes at the State House happening on this day in March in 1913. And they knew that they were probably not going to pass. In fact, by the time they got there, one had already been withdrawn. But that was not the point of this march. 500 women marched silently into the State House to show their leaders that they were united, and knowing that they were probably going to be denied suffrage that day, to make that these politicians look them in the face and deny them their rights while they stood there. And one interesting thing about this, because they marched in silence, because this wasn't, a demonstration, this was a protest. Because they marched in silence, the newspapers actually accused them of not understanding what was going on. So when one of the bills was voted down and they didn't, there wasn't some huge uproar, the newspaper said, oh, they obviously didn't understand. But our research has shown that they actually penned the bill. Of course, a male legislator had to introduce it, but one of the suffrage groups actually wrote the bill that was being introduced. So their silence was meant to convey their disapproval, their unity, and to make their presence felt in that moment.
What did opposition to the suffrage movement look like here in Indiana?
Well, kind of like it looked everywhere else, too. It could be from various classes and various groups of people. There were some organizations of like anti-suffragists, but mostly they'd be ridiculed in the papers. You'd get people, you know, that would come out and say, well, I don't need the vote. My husband can vote for me. I trust my father to make these decisions. But in some ways, there's just a lot of misinformation about sort of what they wanted and what their goals were. And there was just fear about what this would mean.
One of the things that is really fun, if you look through some of the newspapers at the time, is suffragists, women that were pro-suffrage, pretending to be anti-suffrage and having these debates to show how ridiculous that position was, to show that, you know, even if you're anti-suffrage, like, there must be something you believe in, like maybe better schools or more parks. Well, at a certain point, you're going to hit that catch 22 of, we can't achieve our rights because we can't influence our legislators because we don't have the vote. So,
and suffragists would use that specific line of argument. I'm glad you brought that point up, Jill, because they would use their roles as wives and mothers to sort of counter the anti-suffrage thing. Like, we can't be as effective mothers as we need to be if we can't protect our children, if we can't make sure that they're eating clean food and drink and are protected at school and these things, if we can't control sort of our own destiny via the ballot.
How do you think things stand now if we look back to all of these movements and things that women did to gain their rights and whatnot? How do you think things look now? Was all of that valuable or was it for waste?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is at the first Women's Rights Convention that was in Dublin in Wayne County, Indiana, in 1851, the small group that met there passed resolutions that we would recognize as fights that are still going on today. They called for equal access to employment and education and equal pay for equal work. You know, we're still fighting for these things.
And I think the point that I would make here, too, on top of what Jill just said, is that the fight wasn't simply over when they got the right to vote. And many of the women at the time knew that, but not only in Indiana, but particularly in the South, but also in Indiana, you know, a lot of Black women were quickly disenfranchised. Native American women still didn't have the right to vote. Asian American women still didn't have right to vote till the mid, you know, 20th century. And, you know, it didn't mean that women were equal across the board for those very reasons that Jill just listed, some of the issues they were fighting for. So the vote was a huge, important step forward, and it was absolutely critical, but that did not solve everything. And I think the women quickly realized that, and many of them shifted to continue fighting through a variety of different means.
As we get ready to wrap up here, we have about a minute left. I'm curious to hear from each of you where people can go to learn more about the women we've talked about and others.
Yeah, so two main ways we would encourage people to go to the Historical Bureau website, in.gov/history, and click on the map there of all the historical markers and see if there's an important woman by you whose story you don't know, and or if you know of one and we don't, please let us know. We're trying to get these markers, these stories returned to the landscape. And then also we have a podcast called Talking Hoosier History. And, you know, we mentioned Melba Phillips and the South Bend Blue Sox. Those are both really fun podcast episodes.
And we also have a couple of suffrage episodes that go into a little bit more depth about some of the stories that Jill and I just shared. And to reiterate, too, we know that this work is not done. We're constantly, you know, trying to deep dive into original research and primary sources and craft stories for our blog to, again, get the word out. But we're also still working on marker projects. We have, you know, a list of about 15 or so women that we think their stories still need to be told. And so we're always looking for community partners to do that work with us. And so, again, we encourage people to reach out via email, via our website, via our social media to help us do the work.
Well, thank you both so much, Michelle Marino, Deputy Director for the Indiana Historical Bureau, and Jill Wee Simmons, Staff Historian for the Indiana Historical Bureau. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.